friends. My name's Helena Kennedy and I'm a principal here at Mansfield College. And it's a great pleasure to invite you tonight to the Milton Lecture, which is a departure from the normal Mansfield series. The Milton Lecture is something that has been inaugurated here for the last few years. And I will ask our Milton Fellow, David Leopold, to come and introduce this evening and our speaker.
So Helena has asked me to introduce this evening's talk, which I'm very happy to do. My name is David Leopold, and my day job involves teaching political theory in the politics department of the university, but I'm also a tutor here at Mansfield, and my college fellowship, like this evening's lecture, is named after John Milton. And I'm delighted to have that association. Milton has lots of positive connotations for political theorists, not least as an advocate of republican freedom. His religious views, of course, are rather complex, but with an eye on today's speaker, we can at least say that he thought of a free commonwealth as compatible with the principles of the Christian faith. And it's Milton's statue that you can see, but not really identify, high up on the tower over the door to this part of the college. To the nonconformists who established Mansfield, he lent a kind of intellectual authority and a spiritual provenance to their educational endeavours. This annual lecture and my fellowship is named after Milton at the request of Charles and Carolyn Brock. They worked at Mansfield for 35 years before returning to Pennsylvania and have since become generous benefactors to the college. Sadly, Charles and Carolyn can't be here this evening because of Carolyn's continuing ill health, but they remain much loved members of the college community. Charles sends his best wishes to everyone today and adds that he and Carolyn miss what he calls English civilization, especially since, in his own words, we are currently living in the Wild West here in the USA. This is the fifth of these annual Milton lectures, and so I think we're on the cusp of being able to speak of a long and distinguished tradition. And helping to secure that ambition, I'm very happy to welcome David Alton, Lord Alton of Liverpool, to deliver the 2017 lecture. David Alton has had a distinguished parliamentary career. He was a Liberal and then Liberal Democrat Member of Parliament, winning five elections in a Liverpool constituency before moving to the House of Lords, where he sits as a crossbencher, in 1997. He's the author and co-author of some dozen books, including works on abortion, euthanasia, civic virtue, and North Korea, having long pushed for a more creative and constructive approach to engaging with that famously closed and little understood state. In recent years, he's argued especially strongly for the importance of the government's aid programme and the need for British aid to reflect a concern for minorities, pluralism and tolerance. He's emphasised the continuing relevance of Article 18 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and drawn attention to the treatment of Christian and other minorities in Pakistan, Eritrea and Syria. His talk this afternoon is entitled Freedom of Religion and Belief.
David, thank you for that. Welcome to the Wild West of Oxford. In setting the scene for the lecture on freedom of religion and belief, and in thanking Baroness Kennedy, who is one of Britain's most formidable and principled jurists and human rights advocates, and a deeply admired and respected parliamentary colleague, I'd like to invoke, if I may, to begin with, the words of John Milton, for whom these Mansfield College lectures are named. In 1644, at a time of religious flux and political upheaval, John Milton wrote his Areopagitica, a prose polemic addressed to the Parliament of England opposing licensing and censorship. Of course, to a 21st century audience, these circumstances of religious flux and political upheaval had an uncannily familiar ring. But within the Areopagitica, there are some useful signposts to the upholding of difference, the place of conscience, the use of violence, and the confronting of evil. Milton's detestation of narrow imposed conformity is expressed in these words. I fear yet this iron yoke of outward conformity hath left a slavish print upon our necks. His belief in the paramount nature of conscience, in these words, Give me the liberty to know, to utter, and to argue freely according to conscience, above all liberties. His Christian belief in the sanctity of human life and disavowal of violence is recorded in the insistence that he who kills a man kills a reasonable creature, God's image. And he expresses his belief that each of us has to choose between good and evil. He said, good and evil we know in the field of this world grow up together almost inseparably. It was from out of the rind of one apple tasted that the knowledge of good and evil, as two twins cleaving together, leapt forth into this world. And perhaps this is the doom which Adam fell into of knowing good and evil, that is, of knowing good by evil. Well, friends, in the 20th century, in the aftermath of the Holocaust, the world was once again forced to confront the nature of good and evil and how best to defend plurality, conscience, and the difference of religion or belief. The 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights became the civilized world's response to the infamies of the 20th century, from the Armenian genocide to the depredations of Stalin's gulags and Hitler's concentration camps, from the pestilential nature of persecution, demonization, scapegoating, and hateful prejudice. It emerged from the warped ideologies that elevated nation and race. Article 18 of the Universal Declaration specifically addressed the right of every human being to believe, not to believe, or to change their belief. Article 18 promulgated in the aftermath of those defining horrors of the Holocaust, and which has acquired a normative character within the general law, insists that, and these are the words, everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right includes freedom to choose his religion or belief, and freedom either alone or in community with others, and in public or private, to manifest his religion or belief in teaching, practice, worship, and observance. The Declaration's stated objective was to realize a common standard of achievement for all peoples and all nations. Eleanor Roosevelt, the formidable chairman of the drafting committee, argued that freedom of religion was one of the four essential freedoms of mankind, and she described it as an international Magna Carta for all mankind. She said, religious freedom must be freedom of all religious peoples, and she rejoiced in having friends from all faiths and all races. Yet not all were fortunate in having an Eleanor Roosevelt to defend their rights to freedom or religion or belief. The four great murderers of the 20th century, Mao, Stalin, Hitler, and Pol Pot, were united in their secular ideologies by hatred of religious faith. It was the bloodiest century in human history, with a loss of 100 million lives. And now in the 21st century, often in the name of religion, millions more have died or have been forced to flee their homelands. Revealingly, when the 30 articles of the UDHR were adopted by the United Nations General Assembly in 1948, the eight abstentions included the Soviet Union and Saudi Arabia, which argued that there was a conflict with Sharia law, although other Islamic countries, including Pakistan, believed that there was compatibility. The UDHR evolved from the United Nations Charter, which had been promulgated in 1945, and which committed all states to promote universal respect for fundamental freedoms without distinction to race, sex, language, or religion. And alongside the Charter and the UDHR in 1948, the Genocide Convention defined the crime of genocide, the crime above all crimes. It was the Polish-Jewish lawyer, Raphael Lemkin, who had lost 49 of his relatives in the Holocaust, who developed the concept of genocide based on his own family's experience, but also on the experience in 1915 of Armenian Christians at the hands of the Ottoman Turks, and the massacre of Assyrian Christians at Sinope in Iraq in 1933. In that same year, Franz Werfel published The 40 Days of Muzadag, a novel which I read last year, based on a true story about the Armenian genocide. His books were burnt by the Nazis, no doubt to try and erase humanity's memory. Hitler, of course, having famously asked who now remembers the Armenians. The Armenian deportations and genocide claimed the lives of an estimated 1.5 million Armenian Christians. Rabbi Lemkin argued that international cooperation, his words, was needed to liberate mankind from such an odious scourge. Now, the Genocide Convention states that the 147 signature countries had a moral and legal duty to undertake to prevent and to punish. But in reality, as William Hague, our former Foreign Secretary, has observed, there is a significant gap between the commitments states have made and the reality of their actions. Too often, never again has happened all over again. If there's no basis for enforcement rights, such as Article 18, then it becomes meaningless. Unless those whose rights are infringed have access to a remedy, the promulgated words are little more than a fig leaf. And so to try and address this mismatch, the International Criminal Court, the ICC, was established. It began functioning in July 2002, when the Rome Statute came into force and has the jurisdiction to prosecute individuals for genocide, for crimes against humanity and war crimes. By ratifying the statute, states become members of the ICC, and there are currently 124 member states. But three have given notice of their intention to withdraw: Burundi, South Africa, and Gambia, although the latter intends, we hope, to reverse that. And last month, at its conference in Addis Ababa, the African Union was reported to have called on all countries to withdraw from the ICC. The British government say that the African Union wishes to reform rather than completely withdraw. However, Chad's president, Idriss Deby, who was elected African Union chairman at the two-day summit, criticised the ICC for focusing its efforts purely on African leaders. He said, elsewhere in the world, many things happen, many flagrant violations of human rights, but nobody cares. He said that at the close of the summit, and he does have a point. But notwithstanding these reservations, African leaders should not dismiss the outstanding ICC arrest warrant on genocide charges of Sudan's Field Marshal Omar al-Bashir, who's travelled with impunity to Kenya, South Africa, China, Nigeria, the UAE, Saudi Arabia, Ethiopia, Qatar and Egypt, all of which makes a mockery of the court and its jurisdiction. Bashir says the ICC is part of a Western plot against him. And meanwhile, he continues to attack civilian populations in Blue Nile and South Kordofan and is accused of using chemical weapons in Darfur. And it's not just Sudan that basks in the sunshine of impunity. Take North Korea, which has been very much in the news in this last few weeks. 3 years ago, the United Nations Commission of Inquiry, chaired by the eminent judge Michael Kirby, said North Korea's human rights violations make it, and I quote, a state without parallel. Kirby said evidence adduced by the inquiry, quotes, was very similar to the testimony one sees on visiting a Holocaust museum by those who were the victims of Nazi oppression in the last century. And that, quotes, the witnesses told their stories in a low-key way, without exaggeration. But fear of a veto by China has forestalled a United Nations Security Council referral to the ICC. So the ICC is in the invidious position of being damned if it does and damned if it doesn't, in a struggle to obtain widespread international acceptance, with the United States, India and China, as well as most Middle Eastern states, declining even to ratify the Rome Statute, which established the court. And Russia announced in November that it will not now ratify the statute. It did so, incidentally, one day after the ICC published a report classifying the Russian annexation of Crimea as an occupation. Mr. Putin's spokesman said the tribunal had failed to live up to the hopes of the international community. He denounced its work as one-sided and inefficient. Tanya Lokshina of Human Rights Watch said, this is a symbolic gesture of rejection, and says a lot about Russia's attitude towards international justice and institutions. Russia, of course, may also be concerned about ICC jurisdiction in Syria, where its forces have been repeatedly accused of war crimes, while the House of Commons resolution of April 2016 that ISIS should be referred to the ICC for genocide against Yazidis, Christians and other minorities has also never been acted upon. And meanwhile, across the Atlantic, on January the 26th, the New York Times reported that the Trump administration would not continue to fund the ICC. perhaps unknown to Mr. Trump, the US has never actually been a member of the ICC. But like Putin, Trump fears ICC criticism and possible prosecution, and in the case of the US, the investigation perhaps of troops in Afghanistan. I tell you all this because if we don't have effective remedies against crimes like genocide, where does that leave us? Building on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the Genocide Convention, the great hope of the ICC was that the pursuit of justice would temper behaviour and be an instrument for peace. The withdrawal of members, though, and the failure in too many instances to bring principal offenders to justice risks the emasculation and discrediting of the ICC. And meanwhile, the resurgence of nationalist politics to the fore in Brexit, Donald Trump's presidential election victory, and with the rise of the far right in Western Europe, it suggests a tide may be turning against international organisations and institutions just when they are most needed. Fatou Bensouda, the ICC's chief prosecutor, says any act that may undermine the global movement towards greater accountability for atrocity crimes and a rules-based international order in this new century is surely, when objectively viewed, regrettable. That's putting it mildly. 70 years after Nuremberg and the Holocaust, global justice is still clearly a work in progress. For the United Kingdom, the entrenchment and development of the ICC should be a long-term priority, ensuring that perpetrators of genocide and crimes against humanity are brought to justice and their victims across the world are treated equitably and without fear or favour. However long it takes, we have a duty to bring to justice those responsible for abhorrent mass executions, sexual slavery, rape and other forms of gender-based violence, torture, mutilation, the enlistment and forced recruitment of children, and persecution of people for reasons of religion or belief. Now, lest my remarks appear thus far to be purely theoretical, let me divide the rest of what I want to say into a snapshot of what the reality is on the ground and how we might respond. The annual Pew Study Survey, details of which actually appeared again for this year only in the last 24 hours, found that 74% of the world's population live in countries where there are violations of Article 18. And in every single country where there are violations, an estimated 250 million Christians are persecuted. Put simply, it is a moral outrage that whole swathes of humanity are being murdered, terrorized, victimized, intimidated, deprived of their belongings, and driven from their homes simply because of the way that they worship God or practice their faith. As secular liberalism has become increasingly intolerant of religion, old certainties have been displaced, while Islam has been used by some to pursue their beliefs in a manner that countenances no alternative view of life. In this new dispensation, the ignored infringement of freedom of religion or belief very easily morphs from discrimination into persecution, and then all too easily morphs into crimes against humanity and genocide, and without adequate instruments or institutions to prevent or contain it. Jonathan Sacks, our former chief rabbi, Lord Sacks, says, the persecution of Christians throughout much of the Middle East or sub-Saharan Africa, Asia and elsewhere is one of the crimes against humanity of our time, and I'm appalled at the lack of protest it has evoked. What is happening to Christians in these places is the religious equivalent of ethnic cleansing. But many others suffer too. People like Alexander Ung, imprisoned in Indonesia for 2 years after putting on his Facebook site that he didn't believe in God, or Raif Badawi, the Saudi Arabian atheist and blogger, sentenced to 1,000 public lashes for publicly expressing his atheism. Or Asia Bibi, condemned to death in Pakistan for so-called blasphemy. Having spent 5 years in prison, her case has again been adjourned. One quarter of the world's countries have blasphemy laws. More than one in 10 have laws penalizing apostasy, both used to falsely accuse, intimidate, and persecute. Whether judged by Asia Bibi's case, the Lahore massacre, or the assassination of the country's Christian Minister for Minorities, Shahbaz Bharti, and his friend Salman Taseer, the Muslim governor of the Punjab, who both questioned the blasphemy laws, Pakistan has wallowed in a culture of impunity. Following a visit I made a year ago to a detention centre, in Southeast Asia, where escaping Pakistani Christians and Ahmadis are incarcerated. I collected evidence and launched a report cataloguing this systematic campaign. One escapee recounted how his friend Basil, a pastor's son, was targeted by Pakistani Islamists. Having failed to convert him, Basil, his wife and child, were burnt alive. The assailants then turned their attention to his friend. Attacked and beaten, he reported this to the police. They informed the assailants, who threatened to kill him, his wife and little girl, and they fled the country. Recall that in 1947, Muhammad Ali Jinnah, Pakistan's great founding statesman, called to the bar at Lincoln's Inn, crafted a constitution which promised to uphold plurality and diversity. Jinnah said, "You may belong to any religion, caste or creed. That has nothing to do with the business of the state. Minorities, to whichever community they may belong, will be safeguarded. They will be, in all respects, the citizens of Pakistan, without any distinction of caste and creed." But note, friends, that none of the £1 billion of British aid given to Pakistan over the last 2 years has been specifically used to promote Article 18. And UK policy insists that what is occurring in Pakistan is discrimination, not persecution. But words like discrimination, persecution and genocide have direct implications for asylum policies and aid policies. And that is why it matters that we use words correctly. Or think elsewhere, or places like Iran, with almost 1,000 executions last year, including the execution of Baha'is, or how Saeed Abedini was imprisoned for 10 years for undermining national security. What was that? It was by hosting Christian gatherings in his home. Lady Kennedy and I both spoke in a recent House of Lords debate about the egregious violations of human rights in Iran. Elsewhere, violations of Article 18 has led to Chinese Catholics like Bishop Cosmas Shi Zhenxian, who died last year aged 94, having to spend half his life in prison. To Chinese Protestants, since the beginning of 2016, seeing 49 of their churches defaced or destroyed, crosses removed, a pastor's wife crushed to death in the rubble as she pleaded with the authorities to desist, and young Christian lawyers trying to defend them being arrested and disappearing, and to the harvesting of organs of Falun Gong practitioners. Think too of countries like Sudan and Nigeria. In Sudan, Maryam Ibrahim, a young mother of two, was charged and sentenced to death for apostasy and to 100 lashes for adultery. Refusing to renounce her faith and before being freed, she was forced to give birth shackled in a prison cell. And there are currently two pastors languishing in Khartoum's jail. One was given a life sentence last month. Archaic and cruel laws lead to stoning and lashings, with Al Jazeera reporting that in one recent year, 43,000 women were publicly flogged. Meanwhile, Sudan's leaders, indicted by the International Criminal Court for genocide, continue to carry out their bombing of Darfur, South Kordofan, and Blue Nile, home to many who don't share the regime's religious ideology. And note, with famine being declared in South Sudan, only the second time an official famine has been declared this century, this is the legacy still of the 2 million deaths that occurred in South Sudan during the campaign against it by Khartoum, an area I visited during that civil war. And the country, despite being the newest country in the world, never had the chance to recover. Or think on the other side of Africa, of Nigeria, of the 200 schoolgirls abducted in Chibok by Boko Haram, whose jihadist ideology also seeks to stamp out difference and to eradicate diversity. The words Boko Haram meaning, of course, to eradicate Western education. And who can ever forget the execution by ISIS of Egyptian Copts in Libya after their refusal to renounce their faith, or the burning or bombing of more than 50 of Egypt's churches in Egypt's Kristallnacht. And only this week I tabled questions in the House about the fleeing of Christian Copts from the Sinai Peninsula, where they're being hunted down. There are public statements by ISIS within the last 7 days saying that they will be next. Think too of the plight of Rohingya Muslims in Burma, or North Korea, which I mentioned earlier. I co-chair the All-Party Group on North Korea and have been there 4 times. The United Nations Commission of Inquiry, chaired by Mr. Kirby, that I mentioned earlier, concluded that around 200,000 people are incarcerated,
along with assassinations, executions and torture, that United Nations Commission of Inquiry report says there is an almost complete denial of the right to freedom of thought, conscience and religion, and that severe punishments are inflicted on people caught practicing Christianity. I chaired a hearing in Parliament which was addressed by this lady, He Wu, a Christian woman who escaped from one of the camps. She gave us graphic evidence of her time inside a camp where torture and beatings are routine and where prisoners are so hungry that they're reduced to eating rats, snakes or even searching for grains in cow dung. She said that in such places, the dignity of human life counted for nothing. And think of benighted Syria and Iraq. The House of Commons, the American Congress, the European Parliament, and many other legislative bodies have all declared today's crimes in Syria and Iraq against Christians and Yazidis to be genocide under the terms of the Convention. The Times newspaper said the destruction of Christians now amounts to nothing less than genocide, while Boris Johnson said ISIS are engaged in what can only be called genocide, though for some baffling reason the Foreign Office still hesitate to use the term genocide. Well, now that he is Foreign Secretary, it would be good to see if they might start using that term. In Hillary Clinton's view, what is happening is genocide. Pope Francis said that Christians are subject to genocide. His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales, condemned horrendous and heartbreaking persecution and spoke of his anguish at the plight of Christianity in the Middle East, in the region of its birth, describing events in Syria and Iraq as an indescribable tragedy. This annihilation of Christians is one of the crimes against humanity of our time, and I'm personally appalled and deeply shocked by the lack of protest that has accompanied it. In 1914, I referred to the Armenian genocide, Christians made up a quarter of that region's population. Now they are less than 5%, and it's been a sort of continuing slow burn genocide. Archbishop Bashar Warder of Erbil, during a meeting I chaired at Westminster, underlined their traumatic, degrading and inhuman treatment, pleading with the international community to provide protection. The same plea was made in Parliament by a remarkable Yazidi woman, a former Iraqi Member of Parliament. And these are her words, and no one has done more to raise their cry to Westminster than Lady Kennedy. The Yazidi people are going through mass murder. The objective is their annihilation. 3,000 Yazidi girls are still in Daesh hands, suffering rape and abuse. 500 young children have been captured, being trained as killing machines to fight their own people. This is a genocide, and the international community should say so. How will we answer that woman? Do we intend to use our voice at the Security Council on behalf of the Yazidis and Assyrian Christians? We've failed to do thus far. Words matter, and words like genocide, persecution and discrimination all have legal definition, but deeds matter even more. This Baedeker's Guide of Discrimination and Persecution is by no means comprehensive. Unless you dismiss this as simply about faraway places of little concern, who amongst us expected, 120 years after the Dreyfus case and 70 years after the Holocaust, to hear again the cry of death to the Jews on the streets of France and Germany, or to learn in this country of the murder of an Aberdeen shopkeeper in Glasgow, punished for wishing his Christian customers a happy Easter, or the killing of an elderly French priest at the end of celebrating the liturgies? All this underlines the scale and surely the urgency of the task. Like the canary in the mine, early indications of abuses of freedom of religion or belief are a harbinger of far worse that will come. And conversely, societies that make Article 18 a cornerstone see their societies stabilise and prosper. So let me draw my remarks together in this last section of what I want to say. What might we do? First, we need to understand the nature and the scale of what is happening. Then we need to promote Article 18, consider better ways to hold those to account who violate it, and create a widespread debate about the benefits that flow from the promotion of freedom of religion or belief. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Christian theologian executed by the Nazis, said, "Not to speak is to speak, not to act is to act." And all too often we, surely, are guilty of silence and inaction. Understanding the central importance of freedom of religion or belief is a sine qua non, both in domestic and
the international context, whether fashioning measures to counter extremism or promoting community cohesion, or in trying to understand global conflict and its consequences. For instance, like the 55 million people now living as refugees, many flowing from situations where they have been persecuted. It was the BBC's courageous chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, who said, "If you don't understand religion, including the abuse of religion, it's becoming ever harder to understand our world." When President Trump announced that he was going to ban Muslims from the US, did this demonstrate an understanding of, for instance, the biblical injunction to recognize a stranger standing at our door? Did it understand the difference between someone committed to jihadism and someone who is not? And by conflating Shias and Sunnis, it bizarrely links Iran to ISIS, while Iranian Shiites are, of course, enemies of ISIS. So although 90% of Americans believe in God, it doesn't necessarily mean that they understand religious belief. And I suspect the same may be true in the UK too. And in the United Kingdom, the public expectation is that notwithstanding Alistair Campbell's assertion that his government didn't do God, politicians have to have such an understanding. And indeed, a poll published only last week by ComRes found that nearly half of all British citizens expect their politicians to understand religion or belief. Barack Obama was right when he said that it's a practical absurdity for politicians to ask people to leave their faith at the door. Perhaps he had in mind those political elites who, like the Soviets of the 1980s, thought the world would inevitably become secular and that it was their job to make certain that religion was eradicated. In 1917, after they seized power, the communists who adopted atheism as a state philosophy banned any kind of religious awareness. I'm very conscious that Canon Michael Bordeaux is here tonight, and of course he founded Keston College, which in those days was the place that monitored everything that was happening in the Soviet Union, and it prompted me to become engaged in these issues in those days, and indeed to travel to that part of the world. Lenin called any religious sense, even toying with the idea that God exists, an unspeakable abomination and a detestable plague. In 1923, a revolutionary court in the Soviet Union sentenced God in absentia to death. They shared the belief of the German philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who triumphantly proclaimed, "God is dead, and we killed him." But in the 1980s, when I travelled in places like Ukraine, I saw the closed churches and met the families of Christian and Jewish believers sent to gulags or psychiatric institutions. Millions of believers died, it's true, but God certainly did not. And despite their best attempts, religion remains part of the human condition. For most people in the world, religion isn't just about their personal belief, but it's the prism through which they view all other things and through which communal and individual identity is fashioned. Worldwide, more than 8 in 10 people identify with a religious group, with 5.8 billion religiously affiliated adults and children around the globe, representing 84% of the world's 6.9 billion people. And with 84% of the world's population declaring a religious faith, refusing to eliminate God, it's clear that the world isn't conforming to that premise, and it begs the question, just who is on the wrong side of history? And certainly, if you don't understand and respect what makes people religious, you can't possibly understand the world. But understanding is one thing, and the insistence on the right to believe, to change your belief, or to have no belief is another. Article 18, then, is a foundational human right. Many would say the foundational right. Too often it's a forgotten right, a neglected right, an orphaned right. While there should be no hierarchy of rights, and all rights are interdependent, without freedom to choose, practice and share, without coercion and change your beliefs, what freedom is there? At every opportunity, we must surely promulgate freedom of religion or belief. When we in the United Kingdom say we don't need a special envoy, for instance, to promote this because every ambassador will do so, we need some way of benchmarking their effectiveness and their efforts. And when the government say this is, and I quote, one of the government's key human rights priorities, we need to provide resources which are commensurate with the scale of this challenge, certainly more than the one full-time Foreign and Commonwealth Officer desk officer just committed to promoting freedom of religion or belief. Compare the £34 billion spent on military operations since the Cold War with the paltry resources deployed in promoting Article 18.
And I would just note that as the 34th session of the United Nations Council on Human Rights is meeting, as it is this week in Geneva, that it was disappointing that in the opening statement by the United Kingdom at that session, no mention whatsoever was made in the opening statement of freedom of religion or belief. So we need a consistent, coherent, articulate international strategy. It's inconsistent to denounce some countries while appeasing others, particularly those complicit in jihadism, through financial support or the sale of arms. For example, since the present conflict began in Yemen, we've sold £3.3 billion of arms to Saudi Arabia. We're perceived as hypocrites when business interests determine how offended we are by egregious human rights violations. And we can, constructively, be much more proactive in galvanising an international strategy. Nelson Mandela once said that the Commonwealth makes the world safe for diversity. Surely we should be using it more. Kofi Annan called the BBC World Service Britain's greatest gift to the world, and it now reaches some 265 million people. In deploying smart power, what better vehicle is there? And social media, ruthlessly and grotesquely used by ISIS, well, the next generation are being reached by the internet and smartphones, but the religious and secular communities are failing to counter this with common perspectives, common ethical ideals, and of understanding how we can learn to live together, working together for the common good. We urgently need a persuasive new narrative capable of forestalling the unceasing incitements to hatred which pour forth from the internet, capturing unformed minds and manifesting themselves in hate crimes, discrimination, persecution, and worse. As General Booth, the founder of the Salvation Army, observed, the devil needn't have all the good tunes. Facebook has a Bible page which has 4.5 million followers, while the God Wants You Too Now app has 2 million active users each day. But on the other side of the coin, note too, as John Milton most certainly would have done, that there are 44 countries worldwide that censor the internet, and the five worst offenders, when measured against the criterion of an open and free society, are Saudi Arabia, China, Vietnam, Yemen and Qatar, while of course North Korea completely bans the internet. Look, though, at the direct correlation with the curtailment of freedom of religion or belief. If we're to successfully combat this, Jews, Christians, Muslims and others must no longer see one another as an existential threat. The media and scholars must help with this task. As part of the deeper interfaith dialogue, scriptural texts must be placed into their proper context and not turned into a pretext for violence or as a justification for ridiculing and demonising others. Genuine dialogue would seek common ethical imperatives and understanding what can guide us in the complex times in which we live. People of faith and no faith must understand and enter into one another's stories. Jonathan Sacks again reminds us how the displacement narratives of Isaac and Ishmael, Jacob and Esau, Leah and Rachel can all be used to promote mutual respect, coexistence and reconciliation. He says in his wonderful book, The Dignity of Difference, the great faiths provide meaning and purpose for their adherents. The question is, can they make space for those who are not its adherents, who sing a different song, hear a different music, tell a different story? On that question, he says, the fate of the 21st century may turn. Those societies that make space for those who sing a different song see many blessings. We should better emphasise, as the academic Dr. Brian Grinn has done, the tangible benefits that accrue to a society that protects its minorities, encourages diversity, and promotes freedom of religion or belief. On the credit side of the balance sheet, never forget the contribution that people of faith have made to the development of our institutions and to society. Religious networks are often at the forefront in opposing corrupt or authoritarian regimes, in fighting for the dispossessed and most vulnerable in our society, and in shaping peace and reconciliation. In 1965, Dignitatis Humanae, the Second Vatican Council's proclamation on religious freedom, correctly observed that a society which promotes religious freedom will be enlivened and enriched, and one that does not will decay. And finally, perhaps we also need a new convention on religious freedom to sit alongside the Convention on Genocide. But if we promote such conventions, let's dedicate ourselves to upholding and enforcing them too, and with universal application, making sure that words like genocide, persecution and discrimination are matched by deeds and are reflected in the way we do business with, sell arms to, or provide aid programmes to those who violate Article 18. So in examining the obligations that flow from Article 18, in providing a snapshot of the state of the world, and in suggesting some of the things we might do, you might still be asking, is freedom of religion and belief relevant? It is because, as Lise Doucette pithily remarked, if you don't understand religion, including the abuse of religion, you won't understand what is happening in our world. It is, friends, because it's a moral outrage that in the 21st century, men and women and children are being executed, terrorised and relentlessly persecuted because of the ways in which they worship God, and it's because every person should have the right to be able to do that without fear or failure. This matters so much. Thank you for listening.